I think if you can come in and find any seats that remain as quickly as possible, because I think if we can, we should try and get as much, squeeze as much time out of this session as we can, because I know some of the panelists want to be controversial and create debate. So let's try and get some time for that. So my name is Helen Rees. I'm from the University of Witwatersrand in South Africa, Johannesburg. I chair a unit which is actively involved in this field of research called the Reproductive Health and HIV Research Institute, and I also serve on our National AIDS Council with a portfolio for prevention research there as well. So I'm delighted to be a co-chair of this session, which is going to look at the use of antiretrovirals for prevention, PrEP, PEP, and ART. I'd like to also just introduce my co-chair as well, who's Dr. Tegwes Tegoma, who's the Director General of AMREF, and she was previously the Deputy Director General of the HIV Department in the World Health Organization, and later Acting Director of that department. So we'll move straight into the speakers, but I think that the fact that this room is full is because this is actually a very, very topical area. I suspect that this conference is going to be remembered for many things, the human rights issues clearly, but it's going to be one of the conferences where the issue of using antiretrovirals for prevention and some of the challenges that this pose are going to be noted for discussion. In my own setting, I used to have and still have vigorous arguments with my treatment colleagues, as I come from a prevention background, about their take, which was, why don't we just treat everybody and then we can all pack up and go home. I think that finally the prevention and treatment, we really are talking to each other and we really are at a point of thinking about this. And I hope that in 2 years' time, what we will be seeing is not discussing proof of concept and whether we think this will work, but harder data. We've already had some very good news from tenofovir gel study, as we all know, but actually looking at some of the programmatic challenges that should some of these approaches work, how we introduce them and what that means in programs. So the first speaker today is Dr. Fritz van Grinsven, who is with the Thailand Ministry of Public Health and a US CDC collaboration in Nontaburi in Thailand, where he leads the Siloam Community Clinic and the Bangkok MSM cohort study. His main interest is HIV prevention research, and he's been a long-time proponent of intermittent PrEP. He's also the co-principal investigator of HBTN-067, which is a phase 2 trial examining the use of different intermittent PrEP regimens in humans, the first of its kind. Fritz.
Thank you, Helen. So this afternoon I will try to highlight a number of issues related to PEP, PrEP, and ART for prevention in MSM. I'm certain that I will not be able to touch upon everything, but a few things I think we can address in the 15 minutes that I have. This slide actually I show on behalf of all the speakers here is just to let you know where we are. We are in 2010, as you all know. We just enjoyed the results of CAPRISA. And these lines indicate the other trials that are currently going on or have finalized here on the left, and the ones that are coming in the near future with their results and still being conducted. So here's the CAPRISA trial. We just learned the results of that. IPREX, multi-country trial in MSM, I'll talk a little bit more about that later, is scheduled to release results later this year. The Botswana trial, CDC trial, has changed into a safety study. It's not looking at efficacy anymore. Bangkok tenofovir study, conducted by my own office, is also scheduled for completion later this year and come with results. And the extended safety trial here in MSM, tenofovir, in the United States, domestic trial, will be reported on or later this week on Friday, I believe. So the results will be available to us. It's not an efficacy trial, it's a safety trial. The other trials here down at the bottom, very often more complicated designs with multiple arms, they will be released in the future as they near completion. So in this presentation, I will address a number of issues regarding non-occupational or sexual post-exposure, post-exposure prophylaxis or PrEP, and a little bit about antiretroviral treatment. And then particularly from the perspective of what these interventions may mean for men who have sex with men. Regarding PEP or NPEP, non-occupational post-exposure, I think there are a number of concerns regarding the efficacy. We do not have good efficacy data that support PEP for MSM. And so controlled studies like the one in healthcare workers, they are not available to us to support these programs. Observational studies have been conducted. Some very nice studies have been done, particularly the one in South America and Brazil from Schechter. Very excellent study, but they show no clear effect in either direction, either protection or enhancing transmission. The animal data actually show that that we can expect very little if the antiretrovirals are taken too late. They really need to be taken very quickly, as soon as possible after the exposure, to be effective or to have some effect. Problem is that men usually fail to recognize exposure. They only recognize exposure after they've been thinking about it for a while, and then very often it's too late. And then drugs are taken, but they may not help anymore in terms of protection. So overall, I think the public health impact of NPEP, non-occupational PEP, is considered to be limited and only cost-effective in very specific situations, such as when the serostatus of the index case is known, when the drugs can be administered immediately, then there may be some effect. So in conclusion, I think I haven't talked about resistance and side effects, etc. It's not so important in this perspective here. I think in conclusion we can say that generally it's felt that PEP is not feasible for programmatic scale-up in MSM, but that can be offered on as an individual service on a case-by-case basis. So nevertheless, I think PEP in some way led us to PrEP, because we learned that the medication needs to be taken very soon, as soon as possible. So people have been thinking, well, why not take it then before? If it's so difficult to take it after, why not move it to take it before the exposure? So then pre-exposure prophylaxis came into the picture. So these ideas were then followed up with a number of animal studies, where the drugs were given soon before exposure and then were extended also by giving more drugs after a different period of times in variations in 2 hours before, 24 hours, 2 hours after, 24 hours, etc., etc. What we just want to focus on is the rectal challenge models, because they are the most important for the population that we discuss here today, MSM. So the results actually of these animal models, they are driving the PrEP research agenda of today for MSM. And the results of some of these studies are depicted on this slide. As you can see here, Truvada given daily to the animals, and here's the number of exposures. You can see that all the animals stay uninfected or protected by Truvada daily, even though they had a large number of rectal exposures with SHIV, simian HIV, so no infection occurred. And here there is an intermittent regimen, -2 and plus 22 hours, and also this regimen actually protected all the animals. So this shows as evidence that daily, as well as this particular combination of pre-post, is protecting animals against rectal challenge with SHIV. So these are animal studies, so for the humans that may be a whole different matter. But therefore, obviously, we have the trials that build on this laboratory work or this animal work. And the example here of continuous dosing or daily dosing is the IPREC study. It's being conducted by the PI is Dr. Bob Grant, and I've received these slides from him, for which I'm grateful. The study is currently going on, sponsored by the U.S. government, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, and the producer of tenofovir and Truvada, Gilead Sciences. It's conducted in MSM in the Americas, in Asia, and Africa. It's particularly for MSM because the route of transmission is different. Rectal acquisition of HIV is different from heterosexual IDU transmission. It's the only study currently going on in MSM. It's conducted around the world, and there's one site in Thailand, in South Africa, Cape Town, South America, in Brazil, in Ecuador and Peru, and two what is called domestic sites in San Francisco and Boston. So this study is now fully enrolled, 2,500 people, 11 sites, and we're waiting for the results to be released, hopefully later this year. So maybe next time we're at CROI, you know, we may learn the results of this study. It's just a little bit of information about the design, one-to-one randomization. It's a randomized trial. Active arm is Truvada versus placebo. Daily oral administration, and men are followed for seroconversion and a number of other things that are relevant in this setting. So while this trial is going on, there has been discussion on whether intermittent PrEP would be better. As people have been thinking, it's more in line with the sexual lifestyle of MSM. Most of them are not having sex all the time, and they may not need to take Truvada or another drug daily, which would burden them in terms of pill burden as well as drug burden. So intermittent PrEP may reduce that burden, may also reduce side effects, decrease costs, may actually help to increase adherence and coverage of exposures, and may also help men to increase their safe sex behavior because they need to be aware and need to know when they're taking the pills and may be stimulated to think more about their behavior, which actually may then result in more protection. And intermittent PrEP is also supported by the animal models. And here are some slides from those experiments given to me by Gerardo Garcia, the person who led these trials in CDC. You can see here a number of intermittent regimens that have been tested in these animal studies, minus 22 plus 2 hours, minus 3 days, or 72 hours before, 2 hours after, 7 days before, 2 hours after. And then, and this is important, 2 hours before and 22 hours after, and then the post-exposure variant here, plus 2 hours and plus 26 hours. Now, here are the results of these experiments, and you can see that all the first three groups that I mentioned, like 24 hours, 72 hours, seven days before, it seems like what we can learn from these studies is that the pre-exposure drug needs to be taken a long time before, preferably 24 hours before, and very shortly after, as you can see here, minus 22, minus 3, minus 7, and 2 hours after, gives the best protection. The 2 hours before and 26 hours after, or the PEP module, the protection is less. And minus 2 and plus 22, similarly. So long before, shortly after. And other variations on post-exposure or shortly before or long after, they're not as effective. Now, Some behavioral data have been supporting the idea that MSM are not exposed all the time. And this is some of the data come from the Bangkok MSM cohort study, the study we're conducting ourselves in Bangkok. As you can see here, most of the men in this study actually have only one or two sexual episodes per week. So the majority actually has less than 50% of the men here has sex once a week. The median is one, so the median time people have sex in this study is one time per week. On the right side here, you see people who have sex seven times or 7 days a week, 6 days, 5 days, 4 days. These people evidently would benefit from a daily regimen. For the ones who have two, one, or zero times, they would benefit from an intermittent regimen. Or maybe they should not get a regimen at all because the risk is so low. So if the risk is really in this group, you may want to target your intervention there, and maybe that should be then daily. So these are some of the data that support the idea of giving intermittent PrEP. MSM do not have sex all the time. The majority of people has just one times a sexual episode per week. So it's a little bit in contrast with the overall opinion that MSM have sex all the time at unexpected moments, etc., etc. It's clearly not the case here from these data. Now, if you need to take a pre-exposure dose, you need to know when you have sex. So it's important for MSM to know, are we going to have sex? Then we can prepare either our package of what we need to take, or condom, pre-exposure, any other things that you may need for your sexual events, and get on with it. Now here, these data show us that the far majority, or 70% of the men, actually prepare their sex in our cohort, meaning they make some arrangement, intentional arrangements to get their sex, and they go out to get it. So in that sense, they can also take their pre-exposure dose. In 70% of the cases in this cohort, people plan their sex and can take their pre-exposure dose if they want to. Now, the problem is that those who do not plan, so the other 30%, are the ones at the highest risk. So if we looked at the risk factors for not planning, we see that younger age, lower education, not identifying as homosexual, receptive anal intercourse are risk factors for not planning. So here we are with a problem, an extra challenge, that the ones who do not plan will have a problem taking their pre-exposure dose are also the ones with the highest risk for HIV infection. So that's an extra challenge that you have to face when we start implementing these programs. The next generation of studies will be comparing continuous versus intermittent PrEP. I think that will happen. If IPREC shows efficacy, there will be a move towards seeing that we get regimens that are cheaper, involve less drug, less burden, and can be implemented on a wider scale. So we have to see. We have to wait for IPREC to come out, but I think that's the direction where we're going. So one of these studies is HPTN-067, or the ADAPT study, alternative dosing to augment pill taking study. It's a three-armed phase 2 study looking at daily versus pre-post exposure dosing, as well as standing dosing 2 times a week plus a post-exposure dose. So it's comparing continuous versus intermittent and looking at adherence and coverage, pharmacokinetics and risk behavior in these three arms. It's not a study of efficacy, and hopefully it will start by the end of the year or the beginning of next year. So these data that I want to show you now is coming from Kenya, and it was reported here on Monday. And in Kenya at that site, and I thank Dr. Edward Sanders and my friends from IAVI, Camry, for giving me this slide. They looked at adherence by MEMS caps, an electronic device that registered the times when pills were taken out of a bottle, and self-reports. And men were asked, men and women, there's a few female sex workers in this group, men and women were asked to take 2 doses, a Monday and Friday, and a post-exposure dose. Now, the MEMS caps actually show that the adherence here, you can see here, the overall adherence is 68% for the standing doses as well as the post-exposure dose. For the fixed doses, the adherence is 55%. And for the post-coital or the post-exposure dose, the adherence, according to the MEMS caps, if I understand the study correctly here, is 26%. So the adherence is pretty poor. Now, this is a small study, and I do not know what all these data mean. There is qualitative data collected here, and all needs to be sorted out, but it doesn't look very good. It looks very good when people are self-reporting, because more than 100% reported that they had taken the post-exposure dose in time. So that's fantastic. It's even better than we may reasonably expect. But it just shows you the challenges and the problems that are ahead of us when we start to implement these regimens on a larger scale. Okay, in the shadow of Caprisa, we still have to work now in the shadow of oral 1% TDF gel. And this slide was given to me by Dr. Ian McGowan, and it shows you the oral application as well as the topical application, and the maximum representation in blood and tissue is in the middle. So it may be that in the next studies that we're going to do, we're going to see that there will be a combination of both topical as well as oral formulations of tenofovir, and that may maximize maybe the presence of the drug in the areas of transmission, and maybe the most efficacious. I think that's where we are going. And particularly here is important the CHARM program, which is directed by Dr. McGowan at the University of Pittsburgh, and that is actually specifically directed to evaluate rectal microbicides and among others for MSM. Not only MSM, also for heterosexual women, but also for MSM. So we are looking to this consortium to produce or to give us the results in the next future that we're all waiting for. So a number of rectal studies that in phase one that have been conducted or ongoing, the number is small, and there's more studies that are being planned, particularly with the formulations here, tenofovir, UC781, or combinations thereof. So that's in the pipeline coming. So for the phase 2 studies, what would we want to do? So we have phase 1 information, supposedly the safety, everything is okay. We move to phase 2. We would look at receptive anal intercourse to protect men and women, high-risk populations. We move to phase 2B. We would need to have sufficient incidence. And we can find that incidence in certain sites in North America, Latin America, the Asia-Pacific, and Thailand, as well as in South Africa. Just want to mention a study that we are planning, the MTN, the Microbicide Trial Network 017. It's a phase 2 multi-site randomized crossover design of a single oral, single topical rectal, and the combination thereof, oral and rectal application of tenofovir. We didn't plan this study after Caprisa came out. We were already working on this for several months. Prior to that, we knew that the vaginal application of tenofovir would give, you know, that fantastic protection in women. Possibly, if it all works out, we may roll this over into a phase 2B or phase 3 efficacy trial. This is not going to be tomorrow that we'll have these results, and for the phase 2, it's probably, you know, 2013 that this will be completed, and we may move to phase 2B, phase 3. Before that's completed, it's 2016. Before, you know, it's being out there for review, 2017, 2018. If we're very, very lucky, we may have something that we could use in phase 4. So we're really talking about, you know, 10 years at least before we're there to have, you know, a rectal microbicide that can go into the phase 4. And then everything needs to work in our advantage. So let's pray for that. ALT is prevention, the last part, and there's two components, the test and link and the test and treat, that are important here. In fact, they do not differ that much. This slide I received from Dr. Mestro from Family Health International and shows you how this works. People get tested. If they're found positive, they're being counseled for safe sex. They either enrolled in care, linked, or they're immediately giving antiretrovirals. Either when it's indicated or immediately, that's the test and treat, or when indicated, it's test and link. And that lowers the viral load, and that will decrease then the HIV transmission. So the rationale, I'm almost finished. The rationale is lower viral load reduces transmission. Antiretroviral treatment reduces viral load, so treatment reduces transmission. And Dr. Myron Cohen will review this for us later during the session. However, we do not have any transmission studies in discordant MSM couples. So the impact of treating the HIV-infected partner on the transmission in MSM has not been evaluated. So those data are not available. Nevertheless, you know, these ideas are now being implemented on a large scale around the world, but the supporting data is not there. So we need that data, and I understand from one of my colleagues in Sydney, Dr. Andrew Coolidge, that they are planning to do a 350 discordant couple study and look at these issues to see if we can find the supporting evidence. In the meantime, San Francisco in April this year issued the San Francisco guidelines offering treatment to all HIV positives regarding of CD4 and viral load. In San Francisco, they have found a strong association between the mean community viral load and a reduction of newly identified cases or reported cases from, that says 2008, it should be 2004 to 2008, 798 in 2004 to 434 in 2008. So this is an ecological study, it's not a causal study, but it's a study supporting the idea that bringing down community viral load will reduce the number of new infections in the community. So this is San Francisco. It's a very special situation where they have good surveillance data as well as access to antiretrovirals for everybody. These are some of the slides. You can see this in the report written by Das in the PLOS Medicine. PLOS. It's published in PLOS, so you can go there to see these very nice slides. You see this shows the mean viral load per district, per census district in San Francisco. And you can see the poorer areas of the city have higher mean viral loads than the more affluent districts like the Castro and Noe Valley, where the, you know, more affluent people live. Also, most of the MSM live, and they have lower mean viral load. This is total viral load, and this is the effect what I talked about. You see here the decrease in the viral load, the gray bars, And then here in the red line, the blocks, the decrease in the number of new reported cases, and here the decrease in the estimated HIV incidence according to the CDC detuned assay. Okay. There's always challenges. I don't want to go away here, you know, with you thinking, well, that's all very nice and we're almost there. There will always be many, many challenges, and there is a number here that I'm listing. I'm not going to go through them. I'm just going to tell you there will be a lot of obstacles, there will be a lot of problems, and we're far from there yet. In conclusion, PEP, what I talked about in the beginning, is not ready for programmatic implementation but can work on an individual basis. Daily PrEP results are expected soon, and if there's efficacy, the studies will try to identify regimens that are non-inferior but cheaper and have less drug and pill burden. Those are the next steps. If there is efficacy for daily, there will be many implementation issues, and I cannot touch upon them all here right now, but I'll tell you there will be many, many issues that need to be resolved. Rectal PrEP, obviously we're all very happy and positive with the Caprisa results, but the rectum is really another compartment. And the male rectum or the MSM rectum is another compartment than the female one, and there's other things going on. So that needs to be investigated thoroughly, and that's going to take a lot of time. So we're not there yet. ART for prevention, reasonable. We have ecological evidence, but we do not have any supporting studies, transmission studies in MSM, and those studies are needed. So I'm going to stop here, I believe. I'd like to thank, you know, the people who have supplied me with their slides to give you this overview. And there's a disclaimer, and then finally, I'm finished.
Because of time, we won't take questions now, but I'm sure there are quite a lot of questions generated. But because the talks all speak so well to each other, if we don't have time after each speaker, hopefully we'll have some time at the end for picking up on any speaker that you'd like to ask a question to. It gives me great pleasure to introduce our next speaker, Dr. Julio Montana, who is, I think, probably known, I hope, to everybody here. He is Professor Chair in AIDS Research and Head of Division of AIDS, Faculty of Medicine, the University of British Columbia, where he's also the Director of the British Columbia Center for Excellence in HIV/AIDS in St. Paul's Hospital in Vancouver, British Columbia. He's the current President of the International AIDS Society, and he's the co-chair of this very exciting Vienna International AIDS Conference. We're looking forward to hearing from you. Thank you.
Thank you, Helen. I'm going to update you on the now published results of the paper entitled Association of Highly Active Antiretroviral Therapy Coverage, Population Viral Load, and Yearly New HIV Diagnosis in British Columbia, Canada, a Population-Based Study. And I would like to take this opportunity to thank, first and foremost, Providence Healthcare, the University of British Columbia, the Minister of Health in British Columbia, which generously supported all of this work, as well as the National Institute of Drug Abuse in the United States, which also partially funded the study. Industry partners included Merck, Viv, and Gilead. The authors for this work include myself, Viviane Diaz-Lima, Rolando Barrios, Benita Yip, Evan Wood, Thomas Kerr, Kay Shannon, Richard Harrigan, Robert Hawk, Patricia Daly, and Perry Kendall. As you know, we have abundant evidence that antiretroviral therapy is prevention. We have definitive data indicating that you can stop HIV transmission quite effectively in the mother-to-child transmission setting or the parental transmission setting, as we probably should be referring to it. In that setting, the efficacy of this intervention is such that the United Nations AIDS program has called for the elimination of vertical transmission, which is something that is long overdue. There is some data, which is actually quite compelling, from observational studies regarding the role of antiretroviral therapy in heterosexual serodiscordant couples. In particular, a recent study funded by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, which nicely illustrated that this intervention can be as effective as in excess of 90% reduction of HIV transmission. We have previously published a cohort study where we looked at the community viral load effect of antiretroviral therapy in the British Medical Journal, a year ago, and we elegantly demonstrated that by intervening with antiretroviral therapy in injection drug users, you decrease the viral load and HIV incidence. And please notice that I'm using the word incidence here, because in the rest of the paper I'm going to discuss HIV diagnosis per year, which is not exactly the same thing. In HIV incidence measurements, we saw that the incidence in ID use decreased quite substantially. Mathematical models have been put forward by our group and a number of others, most notably Ruben Granich. However, mathematical models are models, and therefore there has been quite a bit of controversy regarding various estimates that have been used. So, for that reason, I think it's quite nice that we can show you real populational data of what happens as we expand antiretroviral therapy coverage in British Columbia. There are several unique study features that I would like to highlight for you. The first one is that this is a true population-based study. The limits, the borders of this study are the borders of the province of British Columbia. So every person living in the province of British Columbia who is HIV infected with a non-diagnosis of HIV is counted here. It's, for all intents and purposes, an ITT type of analysis. The second thing is that Canada, being having a universal healthcare system, has free access to heart and medical monitoring and everything else that goes with it. And so that I'm perfectly clear, the province of British Columbia is unique in the sense that there are no co-payments, there are no restrictions, there are no deductibles. When I say free access to heart, it means 100% free. The other thing that is unique in British Columbia is that we have one center that is responsible for drug acquisition, drug distribution, and dispensation throughout the province, and the data capture, therefore, is complete. We also have a full data capture for viral load because there is one single reference laboratory that does all of the viral loads. All of that is in our center. In addition, we have a fairly comprehensive program at the BCCDC that has kindly given access to us to monitoring of blood-borne diagnosis, and I'll refer to that further. I want to also highlight that this study composes two distinct phases. In fact, there are three phases, but from the methodological perspective, the first is a retrospective analysis that took place after the first oral antiretroviral therapy, and the second one was a prospective phase, which I will refer to in a moment. So going into the phases of the study, as you all well know, highly active antiretroviral therapy basically was established at the Vancouver Conference in 1996. The summer of 1996, as we were involved in the conference and in one of the pivotal clinical trials that led to the establishment of HART, we had a TEP, and therefore, on the summer of 1996, we were already rolling out antiretroviral therapy. The first line that you see here on the blue shows you the uptake of antiretroviral therapy in British Columbia. This is a so-called INCAS trial. It's a very small little blip there, but this is the first rollout. In the summer of 1996, it should have been 1999 here, that's a typo, we had a stabilization of the use of antiretroviral therapy. You remember those days, the tension between initiating therapy and stopping treatment, and STIs, and so on and so forth. So all of this is driven by the guidelines. The third phase starts in 2004. That's concomitant with the first recommendation by the International AIDS Society USA guidelines that advise against treatment interruptions. Of course, the recommendation became more forceful eventually, but if you look back, we were already talking about it at that time. And with the support of the government, therefore, and with the notion that treatment was good for the people infected with HIV, good for the people in terms of public health, and good for the public purse, we were able to convince the government to allow us to move forward aggressively with the antiretroviral therapy rollout. So you have a unique situation because we have phase one, rapid rollout, phase two, steady state, and then a prospective and purposeful expansion of antiretroviral therapy on phase three. So these are three different staggered phases. I'm not going to bore you with this slide. This can be written in a paper. It's simply to acknowledge the fact that the viral load assay has changed over time, and therefore, in order to simplify analysis, we truncated the lower limit of the viral load assay at 500 copies per ml. It doesn't really matter how you cut the analysis. All of the analysis basically give the same results. Before I show you the data that is in the paper, I'd like to dispel the notion that expansion of antiretroviral therapy invariably leads to increased resistance. This is real data from a real program at a populational level. And what it shows here is that between 1995 and 2010, we have expanded antiretroviral therapy, as I showed in the earlier slide. And on the blue line below, now using 50 copies as the metric, you see that we have increased the effectiveness. This is populational effectiveness of antiretroviral therapy rather dramatically, so that we are operating almost at the 90% at a populational level. That includes all comers, second line, third line, whatever line of antiretroviral therapy you want to count. And the incidence on a yearly basis of HIV resistance, all of the resistance in the province of British Columbia gets done through our program by Richard Harrigan. And so you have here, has decreased. Please note that this is a semi-log scale. So we have decreased HIV resistance by 90%. So let's go back to the Lancet paper from this week. This is now the first phase of the expansion of antiretroviral therapy. The blue line shows the number of people engaging in antiretroviral therapy. You see the new diagnosis for HIV, which were stable prior to 1986, decreased significantly after the role of antiretroviral therapy. As we reach steady state for antiretroviral therapy coverage, you see that the new diagnoses are on a steady state. And on the third phase, as we expand antiretroviral therapy on the blue, you see that new cases are declining. The slope of the uptake of antiretroviral therapy coverage was significantly steeper in the first rollout. Mathematical modeling done by Viviani Diaz-Lima and published in the JID a couple of years ago showed almost predicted these results, again emphasizing that the speed at which you roll out antiretroviral therapy will have a dramatic impact on the variable of interest in this case, namely new diagnosis. We have a special interest in this work regarding hard-to-reach populations, and I'll show you here in the green the fact that for the first decade, if you want, of antiretroviral therapy, we did not have much luck in terms of decreasing new diagnosis in HIV of HIV among intravenous drug users. However, in the last 3 years of the effort and in negotiation with the province and the Vancouver Coastal Health Authority, responsible for the care of the areas most affected by injection drug use, we devised several innovative programs, including outreach targeting intravenous drug users, and as a result of that, quite nicely, you can see a 50% decrease, 50, that is, 50% decrease in new HIV diagnosis among IDUs since 2007. In order to estimate what is the impact that this is having in our community, Bob Hogg actually did these graphics for us, where you look at taking the baseline data point, and then you estimate what would happen if things remain stable using demographic variables. And so you expect that the epidemic would remain stable at the following rate, and this is actually what we saw. You can use that line as your baseline if you want, or a new baseline down here. So there is no significant decrease in HIV new diagnosis in the second phase, and there is again a significant decrease in the third phase all over again. The last time that Myron Cohen saw these results, he wanted to see the CD4 data, so this is dedicated to Myron. There we go. I'm sure he's going to have a couple of other requests for the next time that I present it. But here you have the frequency distribution of CD4 counts expressed in bars, showing in the early days of antiretroviral therapy on these first bars, you see a large number of patients with relatively high CD4s. As you know, the guidelines evolve, things change. We became more conservative, so that's illustrated here, the median CD4 decline. But as you see here, there has been a statistically significant increase in the CD4 counts as a result of this steady expansion. Notice that still there is a lot of room to improve, but nonetheless, the CD4 count is going up. This is the actual table regarding viral loads. I'm putting here basically for transparency purposes and just to give you the sense that it doesn't matter how we look at it, 500 copies, 50 copies, ID use, non-ID use, at the end of the day, the results, they will look the same. So if you allow me, I'll just show you the bars using one particular analysis. This is the population plasma viral load using percent of individuals less than 500 copies. And what you can see is that we had a very nice effect early on the yellow, which is predominantly MSM in our population, suggesting that most of the benefit for the MSM community in BC occurred earlier in this regard. And we had a relatively smaller effect on the IDU community. But on the other hand, we had a greater catch-up effect, if you want, in the IDU community later on. And that explains the sort of the balancing act between these two communities in terms of the preventive effect of the intervention. We can use this data in multiple ways, and a lot of the work is still ongoing. We can stratify them, look at frequency distributions within each one of the cells. And in this case, I'm trying to illustrate for you the fact that for the non-IDU, although the cases are growing, they are growing largely at the expense of the soft blue here, which represents individuals who have undetectable viral loads. Now, please do remember that this is the people that know that they have HIV infection. There are approximately 25% of HIV infected individuals in the province of British Columbia that are not aware that they're HIV infected, and therefore our next phase of expansion is aiming to get better at finding those cases. The sick, as we call it, sick and treat, will have a stronger component of sick, which is an area that we could do better. The IDUs, as you can see, not much was happening here, but things are getting better. There is a larger proportion of undetectables. In order to give you a sense of how much more improvement we can extract out of expanding antiretroviral therapy among people who need HIV treatment, and I emphasize this is within people who meet guidelines for treatment, these individuals are all characterized, they are all engaged, and they are all suitable for accessing therapy based on the most recent International AIDS Society USA guidelines that were presented at this conference and now published in JAMA earlier this week. And so we feel that this is sort of the low-hanging fruit, if you want, from that perspective. These people are already identified, and we need to go and engage with them in the discussion of whether or not they want to take treatment for their own benefit and ultimately for a public health benefit. But then there is a more difficult challenge, which is to find the 25% that is not showing in these graphs, and that's where our efforts should go next. A couple of things that you need to know. We're finding less HIV diagnoses, not because we're testing less, but we're testing more. So less cases on the face of more testing, that's a very good background in which we can make these claims. And with regards to other behaviors, this being a population study, I don't have an actual survey that I can tell you who is doing what and with whom. But I do have data province-wide for hepatitis C, infectious syphilis, this is the way they're reported, genital chlamydia and gonorrhea. And I put their Canada data in addition to BC so that I had to accept the fact that Canada is BC is not doing as well as Canada, whereas we have hepatitis C and syphilis, although a little bit better in gonorrhea. But nonetheless, what you see here is that the trends are actually not suggestive that there have been dramatic changes in behavior in our community. So the key findings of our study, we found a strong correlation between the number of patients on heart and the number of new HIV cases diagnosed per year. For every 100 additional patients on HEART, the number of new HIV cases decreased by a factor of 0.97. If you want me to put that in English or Spanish for that matter, it would be equivalent to a decrease on new HIV diagnosis by 3%. For every one log 10, decrease in viral load, the number of new HIV cases decreased by a factor of 0.86. I'll just skip that, except to say that we are delighted to know that Michelle Sidibe has put forward the so-called prevention revolution at this conference, embracing fully these notions under his Treatment 2.0 initiative. Thank you.
We'll take a couple of questions now. If you'd like to introduce yourself.
Andrew Grulick from Sydney in Australia. Bernard Herschel, in his nice review of treatment as prevention in the plenary this morning, said just because A follows B doesn't mean that B caused A. And that's a particularly possible explanation in an ecological study such as this one. And the immediate other explanation that I can think of is that injecting drug users mainly transmit blood through contaminated syringes. And in my understanding, in response to an outbreak in Vancouver in the early 90s, there was a very large rollout of harm reduction activities in the 1990s. So isn't that at least an equally plausible explanation for the trends that you're seeing?
Right. So two things. First, this is not just one ecological study. There are two subsequent phases of rollout antiretroviral therapy that elevates the evidence at least a little bit, number one. Number two, this is not the only piece of evidence. We have the recent Gates-funded study and so on and so forth. So we're not just basing these claims on one particular study. Number three is that we use hepatitis C, syphilis, and gonorrhea to actually act as surrogates for background behavior issues. And so what I can tell you is that our province has been very liberal in terms of needle exchange all along, and yet hepatitis C remains very high, and HIV did not drop early, actually dropped over the last 3 years when there has been no change on needle exchange or other such harm reduction practices.
If you could, we'll just take these two questions very brief, if you could make them as brief as possible.
Bob Grant, San Francisco. The other intercurrent process that is happening in many cities is seropositive, seroadaptive behaviors. The preference for seropositives to have unprotected sex mainly with other seropositives. This has been noted in both San Francisco and Seattle, and I imagine in British Columbia it's happening as well. And, you know, by some estimates could account for a large decrease in the incidence of new infections to uninfected people. Do you have data on serosorting in British Columbia?
Yes, we have looked at serosorting, and I cannot quote it a number for you. There is serosorting going on in BC, but obviously it's not working very well because the actual fact is that in MSMs, and I think I tried to make the point, in the latter years, the effect of HEART predates serosorting on the non-IDUs. Most of the effect that we saw in the second phase, and the third phase that would be, the second phase of expansion is driven by the IDUs who don't do any serosorting.
And last question, please.
Robert Remus from the University of Toronto. You showed the ecological associations between uptake of therapy and at least decreasing reported AIDS, HIV cases, which is problematic as a surrogate for incidence. I know one of your slides showed incidence, but we really want to translate it as incidence. But my main point here is that what you really want to look at is the reservoir of infected but untreated, which is really driving force towards transmission, not the number of people you treat, but rather the number of people who are still untreated. So I suggest, and that would obviously have to be modeled, but I suggest that you add that curve to your slide. I think would add some weight to see the actual diminishing reservoir of people who are potentially sources of infection. And, of course, most transmissions are among people who are undiagnosed or not on treatment. So I think that would add to your argument.
Thank you, Robert. Talking to our public health people, they feel that the proportion of people who are undiagnosed HIV infected in the province has remained relatively stable. But we intend to do that. That's a good idea.
Thank you very much.
introduce now Professor Jeffrey Garnett, who is a professor in microparasites epidemiology at Imperial College, London. His main area of research is epidemiology and control of sexually transmitted infections. He is the chair of the UNAIDS Reference Group for Estimates, Models and Prevention, and he has played a part in developing the method used in HIV surveillance globally. He will be doing a presentation on modeling potential synergies of PrEP and ART for prevention.
Thank you. So yes, I'll be doing a presentation on modeling the potential synergies, but to model the synergies, we have to understand how they work on their own. So I'm going to be looking at the impact of ART in reducing HIV transmission, both through treatment of those HIV positive, using pre-exposure prophylaxis, and then looking at the combination of the two. And at first, I'm going to focus on looking at the potential impact of increased treatment coverage with our previous guidelines and our current guidelines, just looking at what would happen if we could reach the people that we currently deem to be in need of treatment. Then I'm going to be looking at some hypothetical examples of the way pre-exposure prophylaxis might work within populations, and then ask the question, when should we be using treatment of positives to prevent transmission, and when should we be using treatment of negatives to prevent transmission? And the way I've approached this problem is, instead of trying to say what's the best model for the spread of the infection with treatment preventing infection, the approach is to ask questions, what factors could reduce the effect of treatment having an impact on prevention, including those factors in our models, to try and understand the limits to what we could achieve through treatment. So there are a number of things that would prevent treatment having an impact on the spread of the infection. The first is if we have really rapid spread of the infection, so by the time we get to people on treatment, the infection's already spread through the population, so we're too late. And that's we're no longer in that situation. The epidemic's been going for a long time. Next, we can think about patterns of contacts of those that are HIV infected. So if the contacts decrease as a function of time since infection, then treatment of people later on in their infection has less impact. And there are three ways that can happen. One is concurrency. Concurrent sexual partnerships lead for explosive spread with primary viremia, leaving less for the later stages of infection. Another is if people have high-risk behavior for a while and reduce their sexual activity. And the third, which we haven't got around to modeling yet, is if we have people who only have sex with people of a similar age as them, and as they age, their activity decreases. So there's still a little bit of work to do, but I'm going to show you results for the first two, adding in concurrency to our models and people reducing their partner numbers over time. The other things that would impact on the success of treatment is poor adherence, poor suppression of viral load, treatment failure, and the evolution of resistance. And I'm sure you're well familiar of the potential for those to reduce the reduction in transmissibility that's achieved by putting people on treatment. An area that hasn't had much focus is what rate do people progress to low CD4 counts. And we have contradictory evidence from sub-Saharan Africa. We've got ART-link studies which suggest quite a rapid progress to CD4 counts less than 350. But then some modelers have compared the dyspnea of CD4 counts in HIV-infected within populations, for example, Kenya, and estimated a lower decline in CD4 counts. So I'll show results for both of those. What I won't show results for is changes in risk behavior, because I think that's fairly obvious. If there's an increase in risk behavior, HIV spread will increase. If there's a decrease in risk behavior, HIV spread will decrease. So I'm not going to focus on that. Okay, so I'm going to be showing results of a model that's been developed by Jeff Eaton, and it's the basis of this model is published in was in Press in AIDS and Behaviour, and it's really based on a model presented quite a while ago by Miriam Kretschmar and Martina Morris that we replicated and then have developed further. So it's a transmission model, and I'm going to be looking at a generalized heterosexual epidemic, including concurrency in sexual partnerships, heterogeneity in rates of partner change, so both concurrency and heterogeneity in partner numbers. Transmission risk within partnerships is a function of time since infection, and then this movement of people over time from high activity to lower activity groups. And it's a stochastic model, so there are repeated runs for a particular population. So what are we putting into the model in terms of parameters? This is an analysis of a reanalysis of data from the RACI and from the Partners in Prevention study, so a recent paper by Donnell, where we've estimated the transmission rate per 100 person years of contact, assuming a stable rate of contact within partnerships, of those in the primary infection, when CD4 counts are above 350, between 350 and 200, and then below 200. And what we estimate from these observed data is that there's obviously a very high transmission risk in primary viremia, which Mike Cohen will talk about. It then drops down to a low level for quite a long period, and then starts to rise up as people's CD4 counts decrease. So we have a bathtub-type shape where we get higher transmission early on and late on in the infection. The length of this high CD4 count when it's above 350 in this graph is taken from the ArtLink study, but as I said, there are other estimates that this is longer. So what happens if I'm an HIV-infected individual and I'm infecting other people cumulatively over my infection? What fraction of those that I will infect are infected at particular stages? So on this axis, we have time since infection. On this axis, the proportion of HIV transmissions that take place. And at first, nearly a third of my infections take place. It then stabilizes and I get very low levels of infections, and then it accelerates as my CD4 count falls below 200. And we can put that in the model, and this is what we get for the different stages of infection, their impact on the proportion of transmission that comes from that stage. So we start off early with many infections coming from the primary viremia, fewer infections coming from late on, and it stays that those with CD4 counts under 100 contribute very little to the epidemic, and we're assuming they have lower risk behaviors. But over time, the contribution of those between 100 and 200 and between 200 and 350 increases. So this is without treatment in the model. And the contribution, according to stage of infection, shifts as people move out of the risk group. So if people move from high risk to low risk, then more of their infections are transmitted early on in their infection when they're still high risk. We can then look at the model with incidence over time with the introduction of treatment. And what we're doing is we're assuming different starting points for treatment, getting to 80% coverage by the time people would have died, but starting at different points with a constant rate of uptake. And this shows you the results when there is a high rate of movement from the high-risk group to the low-risk group. So here, the treatment of those under 100 CD4 count has little impact. Treatment of those with less than 200 reduces incidence by about 25%, and there's a further 15% reduction with a CD4 count less than 350. To look at that in another way, I've plotted over here time since the introduction of the antiretroviral treatment with different starting eligibilities, and we see that starting 80% of the population with an initiation time of 200 can have a big impact on the spread of infection, with about 25-30% reduction in incidence. That's increased by starting people at CD4 counts of around 350 to give us a reduction of around 40%. And we can explore what parameters change this. So this is that fairly short period to CD4 count of less than 350. If we increase the length of time that people are in the asymptomatic period with a CD4 count greater than 350, then that reduces the effect of the later treatment, because more of the transmission is going on before people enter treatment. And here with the CD4 counts of less than 350, we're getting about a 33% reduction in incidence due to the treatment in the model. If we look at a totally different epidemic, one that isn't driven by concurrency in a generalized population, but one that's driven by a small high-risk group, in this case we're trying to represent sex workers of about 2% of the population, which achieves a prevalence of 1.5%, the results are a little less stable, but again, we do get a fairly big impact of the treatment on the incidence of infection. But here, people leaving the high-risk group to become low-risk has more of an effect. So the more people change their risk behavior, the more that reduces the impact of the treatment, which is a result we would expect. So our models are backing up the arguments that putting people on treatment can have an impact on the spread of HIV, and of quite a substantial impact. Then moving to pre-exposure prophylaxis, here we're developing models representing different regions of the world, and the first model we were working on was for West Africa, where we have a detailed representation of the patterns of use of the pre-exposure prophylaxis, and here we're talking daily pre-exposure prophylaxis, looking at it in combination with other interventions. In a model which includes sex workers and regular clients and the general population, taking data from Benin to parameterize the model, where we have movement between the different populations, the sex workers and the women. And we've taken a couple of scenarios. One is optimistic, that we would get good adherence, that we'd have a long duration of use of the pre-exposure prophylaxis, and that we could reach high coverage quickly. One's a more realistic assumption, where we get good 50% good adherence, 5 years duration on pre-exposure prophylaxis, and it takes us 5 years to reach that. And this graph shows the relationship between efficacy on the x-axis, coverage of your pre-exposure prophylaxis in your susceptibles on the y-axis, and then different levels of reduction in infections. So the blue line is 5% infections averted, the red line is 10% reduction in infections averted, and between those lines we have a 5 to 10% reduction in infections averted. And we can choose an efficacy. So if, for example, our PrEP has 80% efficacy, and we managed to get 30% coverage, we'd expect to prevent about 15% of our cases of infection. That's a lot of people on pre-exposure prophylaxis, and it's quite optimistic with the efficacy. If we are realistic, again, with a high efficacy but poorer adherence and longer time to get up to coverage, we get even fewer infections prevented with our 80% efficacy and 30% coverage. But that's using the pre-exposure prophylaxis in all susceptibles. If we can target those at high risk, then we can increase our benefits. And so this analysis just assumes that 10% of the population are using PrEP, but compares the number of infections averted when that's used across all the population and with a situation where most of it, nearly 100%, is used in those with the high risk of acquiring infection. And suddenly you make your PrEP more effective and efficient by targeting those at highest risk. So we need to be thinking, if we do develop PrEP, how are we going to target and get a high uptake in those most at need? And we can look at the interaction between pre-exposure prophylaxis targeted with other interventions and see that it does add to our armory of prevention interventions. The missing piece might be a vaccine that we would want to add, or some other new technologies. So what we're doing by developing these multiple tools is we're identifying different ways of intervening, adding them together, we can have a bigger and bigger effect on the HIV epidemic. Just wanted to talk a little bit about treatment of those who are infected to prevent transmission versus treatment of susceptibles, and I'll try and be quick. What happens is if you look at in a population, those that are susceptible to infection, those that have a stable partner, and those that are serodiscordant, there's not that many. They're an important part of the population for HIV transmission. So it's not that many people to be looking after with the pre-exposure prophylaxis, but its role goes down as their role goes down as we increase the CD4 count at which we initiate treatment. The more people we're putting on treatment who are positive, the fewer susceptibles are exposed to HIV positives who haven't got suppressed viral loads because of treatment. And so that just illustrates this change. With a change from CD4 counts greater than 200 to greater than 350, we get a reduction in the percentage of discordant couples that could benefit from pre-exposure prophylaxis. And we can start to think, if you had a discordant couple, would you be better to treat the positive to prevent the infection, or would you be better to prevent treat the susceptible to prevent infection? If we compare the efficacy of pre-exposure prophylaxis on this axis and the cumulative risk of infection on this axis, where we have ART initiation at 350, we get a stable reduction in incidence of HIV. And as we increase the efficacy of PrEP, we get a bigger benefit from putting the susceptibles on the pre-exposure prophylaxis than treating the HIV infected individuals. This is comparing immediate antiretroviral treatment initiation with PrEP, where, again, if we just put the HIV positive on the treatment, being fairly pessimistic or fairly optimistic, where you have an 85% reduction in risk in those who are on the treatment. So Mike and Julio can fight over whether that's pessimistic or optimistic. But what happens is it's only if pre-exposure prophylaxis is really highly efficacious will it do better than the antiretroviral treatment to prevent the transmission within the couple. What we haven't done yet with this analysis is put the actual costs, both in terms of toxicities and also dollars costs of providing the drugs. Okay, so I'll stop there. Just a few conclusions. Good coverage of those with CD4 counts less than 200, we believe, could avert around 25% of new infections. And you add a further 15% with CD4 counts less than 350 in generalized HIV epidemics in sub-Saharan Africa. Reductions in risk behavior associated with treatment would improve this, and that was included in the models published by the WHO and the Lancet arguing for immediate treatment. An increase in risk behavior, which we have seen in some Western European countries, would undermine it. Pre-exposure prophylaxis can reduce incidence, but needs high efficacy, high coverage, and high adherence, and appropriate targeting to be efficient. So there's a lot of work to be done if we're going to use pre-exposure prophylaxis as a tool. An earlier treatment reduces the role of pre-exposure prophylaxis, and then you have to consider the relative efficacy of the two interventions. So thank you.
Thank you, Jeff. The next presenter is Miron Cohen. Miron is the J. Herbert Baird Distinguished Professor of Medicine, Microbiology, Immunology, and Public Health at the University of North Carolina. He's also the Associate Vice Chancellor for Medical Affairs, Global Health, and he is the Director of the University of North Carolina Division of Infectious Disease and the UNC Institute for Global Health and Infectious Disease. as well as the Associate Director of the University of Carolina Center of AIDS Research. Miron, you have the floor.
Good afternoon. As the last speaker, you know, you guys are tired from listening and time runs up, but I talk so fast that this talk is almost over already. This is considered half done. So I'll use slides, as you might expect, and we've already concluded that antiviral therapies can be used for post-exposure prophylaxis, pre-exposure prophylaxis, and treatment as prevention. I'm going to focus on treatment as prevention. Now, because I think it's important to give a summary, I'm showing a slide, a disclaimer, because Julie and I will undoubtedly get in a fight eventually about this. I've been a big advocate of antiviral therapy as treatment as prevention for a very long time through a series of studies. But in our 1997 paper, we concluded the details really matter. And so what I hope to do in 15 minutes, is provide the details. So the first is the biological plausibility. This is really important. The drugs you choose matter for prevention. So the treatment benefits are very profound and have been explosive and wonderful. We're not 100% sure which drugs to use for prevention. This is a summary from my colleague Angela Kashuba and her group, in which she looks at the concentrations of antivirals in the female genital tract. We've done the male as well, comparing blood to female secretions. And what I want to emphasize here is that not all the drugs actually concentrate in the female secretions. Some, especially the protease inhibitors, have trouble getting in. That's a special problem in terms of the selection of drugs as we do treatment for prevention in general. Chris Patterson in the group is providing a late-breaking abstract tomorrow about Truvada concentrations with interrupted drugs, and raltegravir we've been studying intensively, as well as maraviroc recently. So this, to us, is really important. And I think the importance of the pharmacology can be emphasized by the fact that when you suppress the blood viral load, and everyone wants to show you blood viral load data, you don't suppress the genital tract. So if you look at a meta-analysis by Lillian Brown and our group, there are 422 articles about female shedding and 707 abstracts. 18 of these articles have ART in use, and they demonstrate poor suppression of the genital tract in the face of complete blood suppression. Susan Kuyuvin from Brown has a paper coming out in AIDS that I highly recommend to you, studying 59 women, and she demonstrates that some women are persistent shedders. They're blood suppressed, but their genital tract, you can always recover HIV, and some are intermittent shedders. We see the same thing in men. Now, we're not sure what this means. We don't know how this occurs, and we're not sure that the virus we recover, which is measured RNA, is an infectious unit. Is that virus contagious? But that's really an important research topic for those of us interested in treatment as prevention. Now, people at this meeting have talked nonstop, I think, about observational discord in couples, and I believe those are really important. Debbie Donnell's paper in Lancet got a lot of attention, and I've heard that number. There's a 92% suppression of a transmission in the face of antivirals over and over and over again. I would remind you this is an observational study conducted over a very short period of time, so 7 or 8 or 9 months, but we're talking about lifelong therapy and partnerships that extend a very long time. So I'm excited about observational couple results, but I think it's important for us to kind of think a little more deeply about what they mean. I also want to emphasize a couple of papers. One hasn't been published by Patrick Sullivan and Emery, in which he studied 2,900 couples for 512 days. See that this is a short study. He had 175 transmission events, some of them on therapy, some not on therapy, but the most important thing about this paper is that 4 out of 175 transmission events occurred in couples in whom the index case was receiving therapy. So what's important to us is how are we going to advise patients and physicians about how to manage patients on therapy. So we're looking for a very solid answer to the transmission probability question. There was an 80% reduction in Patrick's paper, not a 92% reduction. And now there's the really cautionary paper, and I hope I'm going to slow down a little because this is important. Our Chinese colleagues from the China CDC, led by Wang Ning, in a paper presented here tomorrow Dr. Liu, but it's by Wang Lu, studied 1,977 discordant couples in Henan between 2006 and 2008. There were 84 seroconversion events. and they were equally distributed among people on therapy and off therapy. Now, what does this mean? The Chinese have a free treatment program. Our colleague Dr. Wu, who directs the CDC, is in the audience. They have an excellent free treatment program. But all programs are imperfect. The infrastructure is imperfect. But the point is, this is the real world. So as we start dealing with treatment as prevention, we've got to pay a lot of attention to the things that don't work or aren't working perfectly as well as the things that do work. There can be lots of explanations for why this was imperfect. Most likely the patients were intermittently taking their therapy, et cetera, et cetera. But it really attracts my attention. This has been accepted as a paper in JAIDS. It'll be published in September for those who are interested. Now, the NIH is supporting a very large study that's been heavily discussed called HBTN052. And that study is designed to ask two questions, but a little bit different than has been presented at this meeting. The study is conducted in 12 sites in 9 countries, and the main question is, in 1,763 discordant couples already enrolled, now in year 2 of a 5-year study, will we see durable, and I emphasize the word durable, prevention of transmission over 5 to 7 years? We're looking for a number. It's not a population-based study. It's not to inform the planet. It's to inform healthcare workers about what was observed under controlled trial conditions about prevention of ART. So that's the main purpose of the study. The study also has the advantage of giving us a little more information in an RCT setting of when to start ART. So we're excited about completing the study, and as I said, it's fully enrolled in year 2. We'll see how it goes. Now, population benefit and modeling. Modeling, 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 modeling. And no friend of my very good friend Jeff, you know, there's going to be more models. And people have pointed out what is important to this audience. Assumptions provide the answer. Some models just said, you tell me what the answer you want, and then I'll fill in the assumptions. So the assumptions provide the answers. And I think the people in this audience need to be not skeptical. They need to provide the data that proves or disproves the assumptions. Because without the data proving or disproving assumptions, we cannot move this field forward. Dr. Ruben Granich's article and Brian Williams is on the bottom. So that's the universal kind of utopian treat everyone, and this is going away. It's in green. But I've provided you not all the models, because there's more than this. In the red are all the models that say the treatment will make the epidemic worse. So depending on the assumptions, you can make the epidemic unchanged, you can make the epidemic go away, or you can make the epidemic worse. And I just think it's the job of the investigators who do this kind of work to do modeling, but to generate data to support or refute the model hypotheses. Now, ecological studies. And if time is available, I am 100% sure there's going to be a massive fight about ecological studies. Ecological studies that have shown a population-level benefit have been completed by my friend Grant Colfax in San Francisco, already published by Julio in Lancet, and a lady from Denmark presented a very nice paper in this meeting. Those are the successful ecological studies. But Dr. Andrew Grulich, already stand up, sees no benefit, even though a lot of ART is available in Australia. My colleagues in Amsterdam have seen no benefit, and the French have to date not seen a benefit. So ecological studies are complicated to interpret, and you already saw people starting to attack Julio. It's just the beginning of the attack, looking for a thing called the ecological fallacy. We even have a word for this. It's the assumption that the association is causation, whereas somebody else introduces an idea that reinvigorates your thinking. A very good example of this is Senegal's epidemic in 2000. In 2000, Senegal had about 2 or 3% HIV prevalence, and that was ascribed to a wonderful public health program. 10 years later, it's primarily ascribed to the fact that 97% of the men in Senegal are circumcised. Now, obviously, it's multifactorial, but we need to be looking for other explanations of why we see things in the general population. Having said all this, this horse is out of the barn. This is the test and treat movement, and it is a good movement. I think most people who want to see ART given at the right time to the right people at the right dose are very excited about this. So what's the summary of the test and treat movement? We have an NIH-supported pilot study by Max Essex in Botswana. We have a HBTN study in the United States being developed by Waf El-Sadr and Ken Mayer. We have a population-based study by the British, led by Sarah Fidler and Richard Hayes, called PopArt, expected to be conducted in Tanzania if it comes through. We have a PTN concept for worldwide, for another trial and treatment Seek and Care, if you want to call it that, by Tim Master and Sally Hodder. Susan Little is leading a trial in Kenya, and we heard from Bernard Herschel this morning and Francois about a study he and Francois are doing with ANRS. So we're going to see a lot of people try and introduce ART and see a population benefit prospectively. That's exciting. My hesitation is we don't know how to measure population benefit very well. And so we can do the introduction of the ART, we can see people taking the therapy, but we need better tools to measure a benefit. And I'll leave you with that thought. Now, there are two inconvenient truths, and I'm going to end with my two inconvenient truths. Inconvenient truth one is about acute and early infection. This is not just a little tiny thing that you model away. This is the idea that the person who's recently acquired HIV has a greater transmission probability than a person with established HIV. This is a wonderful review paper by Andrew McMichael in Nature Medicine that shows you what we call ramp-up viremia that lasts for several weeks with a very high peak viremia, hundreds of thousands, if not millions of copies. And my friends who work with monkeys have demonstrated, led by Dr. Chris Miller, that if you take a tiny little bit of monkey serum from a monkey newly infected, that little bit of serum is maybe 1,000 times more infectious than from a monkey with established infection. That's a virology issue. So acute infection has been modeled or been estimated to be at least 26 times more contagious than established infection. That may be the lower boundary. So people with acute infection can be very contagious. Now, this is a summary of the 11. There are 11 acute infection modeling exercises that have been undertaken. What I want to show you on this slide is if you look at the 11 studies, you get all kinds of different results. The lower boundary of all these results is that acute infection is responsible for 9% of all new infections. The upper boundary is 90%. So these are all over the place. Now, not to be hypocritical, let's do our own study that we model. Kimberly Powers, well, we took a lot of data. Kimberly Powers in our group will present a late-breaking abstract on Friday that I think is very compelling. And in this abstract, she'll provide all of our data from Lilongwe, Malawi for 20 years, where we took every acute infection we saw, what their viral loads were, what their behaviors were, and we model that against the incidence and prevalence of HIV in Lilongwe, especially prevalence. Now, this is the actual prevalence in Malawi over a long period of Lilongwe, Malawi over a long period of time. This is from Kim's presentation. You see that way up here you had 27% prevalence of HIV in Lilongwe. You see down here in late more recent years the prevalence has fallen to about 14%. I want to point out to you ART not started here. We don't know why the prevalence of HIV went down in Malawi. Behavioral changes, government interventions, the natural epidemic itself, but no ART was introduced. And this, again, gets us at the ecology. What our computer data shows us is that we estimate that in Lilongwe, Malawi, over time, 38% of the new cases, of the new incident cases that occur, can be ascribed to acute infection. So from this point of view, that's a lot of patients we would have difficulty finding to deal with or treat if we knew how to treat them. The upper boundary is almost 60%, the lower boundary is 19%. I would encourage you to go to hear this talk if you're interested in the contribution of acute infection. Now, another piece of evidence about the importance of acute and early infection has been led by Canadians, Bloma Brenner and Mark Weinberg in Montreal, Susan Little in San Diego, and our colleague Christopher Hurd in Chapel Hill. These are studies that show acute-to-acute transmission. They show clusters of people, all of whom have the same virus, suggesting that these viruses were passed very rapidly, forming a cluster. Some of these clusters are very big, 60, 70 people, and they can occur very, very quickly. That's the best way of saying it. But so that's one issue. And these clusters usually use drug resistance to demonstrate the cluster. Now, Julio pointed out that for whatever reason, they're doing great in Vancouver. But most of the rest of the planet is very concerned about transmitted drug resistance. And most people find about 10% transmitted drug resistance. And these clusters all are based on transmitted drug resistance. Sally Blower, who's really the mother of a lot of these modeling experiments over the last 20 years, has this very cautionary model that I'll end with about resistance, drug resistance. What she argues is, using Ruben Granich's model, that if you only only have 70% adherence of your daily dose of therapy, you'll end up with a very substantial amount of transmitted drug resistance because people will be imperfect in their therapy and their resistant variant will go to the next person. Now, a little disclaimer. Resistant variants are probably less transmissible. Mark Weinberg has done a lot of work in that area. So maybe the resistance problem, while you might see resistance in the next person, it won't be a substantial threat to the health of the next person. This is a thing we need to understand as we roll out the test and treat movement. So I'll end then as quickly as I can on the last slide. I believe in 2010 that antiviral therapy has the power to reduce onward transmission of HIV. But the magnitude and durability of this tool is unknown, and it's really our responsibility to flesh this out as we go forward. I think the population benefit of antivirals will depend on one. Can we durably suppress transmission from a person who's infected to the next person? What can we reliably tell them with data? That, I think, is important. Number two, can we prevent transmitted drug resistance? How are we going to do that so it doesn't threaten the use of our drugs? And number three, how will we deal with people with acute infection? This is a big challenge because although we're getting better and better tools, we don't know how to do this. And I think as we roll out this movement, we need to deal with these issues. Thank you.
I'm going to sit down.
Thank you all for your presentations. We have 5 minutes for discussion, I'm sorry. But so I can take 2 or 3 questions. So, Renee? Yes.
Renee Ridson from Gates Foundation. I have a question for Dr. Cohen. You mentioned that we need some tools to measure population-based impact. I was wondering if you could tell us what you think those most important tools are, Mike.
Okay. So the most important tools... This might be almost rhetorical, but I think Renee knows my feelings about this. There are two tools that I think are really critical. One is a lot of the studies I showed you are planning on using phylogenetics as kind of a surrogate for understanding how much prevention they're getting, avoiding clusters. And the Max Essex study, Susan Little's. The second thing that is the most critically important thing is the development of a reliable incidence test.
That's the correct answer.
Thank you, Renee. The Gates Foundation is absolutely committed to the development of a reliable incidence test. People earlier this week might have heard a talk by Georgia Tamaris. She and the U.S. CDC are working together on a new test. The Gates Foundation is supporting research in this area. We will get a reliable incidence test.
Thank you. Briefly, microphone number 3.
Hi, Ken Mayer, Fenway Health, Brown University. Excellent talk, Mike, and the whole panel, superb. But it sort of leaves people walking away with the idea, just take the ART, add water, stir. So I think real plea that when we're talking about combination prevention with ART, we have to think not only about adherence and not only about behavioral disinhibition, but linkage to care. There's a lot of presentations at this meeting that you can get people on the drugs, but we're talking about lifetime commitment if we're going to have a public health benefit.
Thank you. Microphone number 2.
Ken Nelson from Johns Hopkins. Mike, I really agree on the importance of acute infection being important in transmission. But I wonder how much does symptoms that occur with acute infection, how much does that modify the likelihood that there will be sexual contact and transmission? We looked in Chiang Mai in a study for symptoms, which were some people have reported being very high, and we couldn't find the looking at those who were HIV positive and converted it with compared to the population, we didn't find a high rate of symptoms, but there were fairly high in the background too. Is that important?
I'm going to give 2 very quick answers to that. One, there is every reason to believe that people with acute infection rarely are sick enough so that they're not going to have sex, because in our own setting, we find the people in STD clinics. Now, we find them with modest symptoms that they don't construe as severe. They're coming because of an STD, not because of those symptoms. But they often will have fever, headache, diarrhea, myalgia, sore throat, mild, though, and not blocking necessarily sexual activity. I don't believe a symptomatic approach to detection of acute infection is reasonable. There's going to have to be some population-level approach, and I'll put in a plug for, again, diagnostics. Newer tests introduced all over the world will pick up many more people with acute infection. Our job is to figure out how to manage them, another challenge for the research community. I'm unaware of any guidelines that are totally secure.
Thank you. Pedro?
Pedro Khan from Argentina. I have two quick questions regarding resistance. I'm not an epidemiologist, I'm just a humble clinician, and I try to understand why we are using a combination, for instance, of tenofovir, FTC, and efavirenz with two drugs with very low genetic barrier over time, and the guidance continue recommending those, and we didn't see an expansion of resistance, albeit we see more and more people on treatment in different settings. This is number one. And second, if we're concerned about resistance in the context of ART as prevention, quote-unquote, why are we not so deeply concerned when we are providing, for instance, a monotherapy with tenofovir as PrEP for people that might be, well, those people at higher risk because they would be the candidates for acquiring primary infection?
I think Julio should answer the first question. I'll answer the second question.
Yes, Julio, maybe you would like to respond also to Mike's question.
I'm glad to hear that Myron has been promoted to moderator. But in any case...
and after you answer, I'll ask...
That was nice, thanks. I think Pedro is right, and I think I have been advocating for quite some time that if I was to try to reconcile the benefit to the patient and the benefit to the system, the public health, etc., I would be tempted to do clinical trials that would compare, say, a traditional triple approach or tenofovir FTC and efavirenz with something different, a ritonavir boosted PI with... something that really could give you a simple, easier, long-term, like no linear monitoring type of regimen. And to be perfectly honest with you, that's the essence of what Michel Sidibe is currently proposing. Now that we understood treatment has a secondary benefit on prevention, despite the fear-mongering that you hear at that end of the corner, what we have to do is give the best treatment to the people, the simplest, the most durable, that has both goals, the best for you and the best for public health. And it can be done.
Thank you. Unfortunately, we will not have time to take more questions. So, two, really, I have no pretension also to summarize this very interesting discussion, but what we have heard is that we have some evidence from PMTCT, observational studies, and discordant couples that ART for prevention works, and all the models are also confirming this. But we still also have a lot of challenge, such as durability, acute and early infection, resistance, and how to prevent transmission of resistance, and so many other challenges. So the way to go is really to have more clinical trials to confirm that ART for prevention really works and is feasible at the population level. And then we come up with a real recommendation on ART for prevention. For the time being, ART for prevention can be used in a combination prevention as a biomedical intervention in the combination prevention strategy. Thank you, and I would like to thank all the presenters.